Hello again, and welcome back to Celluloid Jelly, a podcast featuring a couple of ex-video store guys who just love talking about movies. I'm CJ Talbot, and joining me as always will be Cesar Alejandro Jr. from Filmsmash.com. For this episode, we're discussing Sky Captain and the World of Tomorrow by director Cary Conran.
All right, here we are again. Hey, Cesar, what's going on?
Not much on my end, CJ. How about you?
No, not much. Just working, watching movies. That is my life.
Yeah, I've been trying to watch more movies. I've been kind of absorbed with the Winter Olympics right now.
I noticed that, but you still... How many movies did you watch last week? Five, six, seven?
Maybe like three. I was ahead of the curve before the Olympics started, so I'm kind of coasting on that a bit for like the one movie a day thing.
You hit your 50th movie this week, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
It was E.G. the Killer, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm a little behind you. I'm in the mid 40s.
Yeah. So. They played it at the Parkway Theater.
Oh yeah, the beautiful Parkway Theater in Baltimore, newly restored. Yeah. Love it. Was that your first experience at that theater?
No. I'd seen Blade of the Immortal there.
Okay.
It was only the second. It was in the main auditorium, so I knew what to expect. It is a lovely theater. I recommend anyone in Baltimore check it out for their eclectic offerings.
Yeah, absolutely. Their programming is great, and it's a beautiful place. I had the opportunity to spend like 4 days there during the Maryland Film Festival last year, and then a couple times for other screenings aside from that. And I loved it. You know, pretty conveniently located downtown, right by the Beltway.
Yeah. Right, so. And more importantly, right by Namkang Korean Restaurant.
Yes, your favorite. I love that place.
Yeah.
We've eaten there a couple times.
Yeah. I've been going there in the wintertime, I've been going there like once a week. So,
well, I know I've mentioned this before, regarding like the Senator Theater, but man, you guys in Baltimore don't know how lucky you are to have theaters that are running that kind of programming, like all in like one community.
Yeah.
So between the Charles and its revival series, and the Parkway and their programming, and the Senator, which you know always combines, blockbusters and smaller, more independent films. And is just literally the best theater in the universe. You guys have it great, and I miss it. So when I come back to Baltimore, we're definitely going to see a movie together at one of those places.
Okay, yeah, absolutely.
So,
say, not so happy about that 80-degree weather now, are you?
You know, it's funny. I think it was warmer in Baltimore the last couple of days than it was here in Southern California.
On Tuesday, it was close to 80 degrees.
Yeah, it's only been in the 50s this week here, so... I'm actually wearing a sweatshirt, like a hooded sweatshirt right now. I had to pull it out of storage. But speaking of movies, I know, you know, we both recently saw Black Panther and we have not had a chance to talk about it. Do you want to, tell me your thoughts on that one?
Okay. Well, overall, to be honest, I haven't really spoken about Black Panther to many people. I'm kind of, with it being such a recent release, I'm kind of observing a no-spoiler policy, especially at work.
Yeah, that's a good idea. We used to do that at Suncoast.
Yeah, so Black Panther, the most recent entry in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, I thought was an amazingly great film.
You can go spoiler-free, by the way, if you want to on this.
For Black Panther?
If you want to.
Nah, I think people know what they're getting into at this point.
Right. I figure, fuck it then.
I imagine it might be a couple, like a week or so before you get it up. So I think that's ample time for people to have an opportunity to watch the film. Especially listening to you and I speak. You
know. It's raining spoilers then. Claw dies. Boom.
Yeah, it happens just like in Lord of the Rings.
Nice.
Black Panther, I mean, Ryan Coogler is a director who hasn't let me down yet. So I was a little worried going into it, considering Disney's tendency to kind of take control of a production. Generally, the Marvel films tend to fare a little bit better. And thankfully, you know, I never heard any anecdotes of turmoil on the set of Black Panther. So I believe if like Coogler kind of handled things the way he wanted to, and I think the result was probably greater than they expected.
Well, certainly the box office success has been greater than they anticipated. I mean, it had a whopper of a weekend. You know, I agree with you. I think it's a really good movie. You know, I think it's, you know, visually speaking, and as far as bringing new ideas and cultures into the Marvel Cinematic Universe, it's kind of breaking new ground there. On the whole, you know, I don't think the third act is as strong as it could be. Like, they're still kind of going with the formula of having, like, three cross-cutting battles with one giant space battle, and then one more personal battle, and then more of a army versus army battle, which is something that they've been doing in a lot of their movies. You know, I still really enjoyed it. You know, the design work, the costumes, the visuals are great. The acting's pretty damn good in it, too.
Yes.
So, you know, I was very happy with it. I know Chelsea was even more thrilled with it than I was. She wants to go back and see it again.
Yeah, I do want to watch it a second time. I kind of feel that a second viewing will cement my opinion of the film. I don't want to wait too long before watching it a second time, though. But I guess this week is I do have plans to watch Annihilation this evening. So we'll see how that goes.
Nice. Alex Garland. Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing that over the weekend, too. I'm going to see that and Game Night this weekend, definitely.
So. Okay. I'm not really into Game Night.
I think so. It looks hilarious.
Okay.
Are you not as much of a Jason Bateman fan as you used to be?
Man, I love Jason Bateman. That movie looks good, though.
Oh, it's got Kyle Chandler and Rachel McAdams.
Yeah, great.
All right. I think it looks funny, so I'll let you know what I think next time, then.
Okay, I'll watch Super 8 or The Notebook, and then get my fill.
There you go. I know you're a big Super 8 fan.
Yeah, I'll watch Super 8 twice just for you.
Yeah, watch it once for me, because I won't be rewatching it.
Okay, whatever. You're on shaky ground there, man.
Why? With Super 8?
Yes. You know I love that.
I know you love that movie. I think it's okay. I own it. I, you know, I don't love it the way you love it, though.
Okay.
Is that all right?
That's definitely true.
Is that all right, sir?
It's okay. Yeah. It's acceptable.
Let's not fight on air.
All right, off air.
Save it. Save it for the ring. Ooh. All right, well, have you seen anything else you want to recommend before we dive into Sky Captain and the World of Tomorrow?
Yeah, I guess I'm ready. This is a movie that was your suggestion, yeah?
It was part of a group of movies that I threw out there because, you know, our most recent poll on the Celluloid Jelly Facebook page was about where and how our listeners are consuming movies. And far and away, you know, the number one service that people are using to watch movies is Netflix. So I kind of just went on Netflix and picked a few things that were on there that I thought would be maybe interesting to talk about. And this was one of them. So, you know, I certainly appreciate you, you know, giving your feedback and rewatching Sky Captain. So.
That was not short at all. I quite like this film.
Well, good. We may have some spirited conversation then.
Okay.
I'm
sure it's gonna. I wonder if like this conversation is gonna reflect the conversations we had with this film 12 years ago, 12 or 13 years ago when the film came out originally.
2004. Yes. Yeah. I don't remember those conversations, so you'll have to remind me if I'm repeating myself, but.
You know, I can't recall them offhand, but I'm sure that if we have the similar points, then I think something will jog my memory.
Perhaps. So, well, what's Sky Captain in the World of Tomorrow about?
Well, Sky Captain is an homage to like classic science fiction pulp serials. It's set in a late 1930s, slightly technologically, more than slightly, but technologically advanced 1930s. It's a bit of an alternate universe. Historically, things happen, or things did not happen in this world of the film. And basically, there is an unknown robotic army that is abducting prominent scientists, and it's up to the heroic Sky Captain, played by Jude Law, and his formal girlfriend slash reporter sidekick, Polly Perkins, played by Gwyneth Paltrow, to kind of step up and try to solve this weird mystery of science, I guess.
Nice. yeah, this is, I guess, what is technically considered diesel punk, you know, which is sort of like retro-futurism, you know, which we've seen in other movies like The Rocketeer and League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, Hellboy, Sucker Punch, and even like Hydra in the Captain America the First Avenger movie is sort of based in this sort of fear that fascist regimes and nationalist governments like Nazi Germany would push harder for scientific advancements. And state-sponsored programs like that did yield, you know, some impressive results that made things very difficult for the Allies in World War II. So the German Luftwaffe and U-boats and a lot of their firearms were considered to be more advanced than the Allied troops. So we got lucky there, thankfully.
Well, you know, one of the things I always think that's kind of odd is that, you know, these people have, like, I guess you mentioned, like, Hydra and Captain America, the First Avenger. You know, those weapons and such are futuristic indeed, but, like, I still feel like a bullet could do just as much damage, and it moves faster than, looks like it moves faster than, like, a laser beam.
Yeah.
Like those little blasts. I don't know. Like, if you shot a guy with a bullet, it would still, you know, it would still take him out, probably.
Yeah. Well, like, the things in Sky Captain are, like, the designs are appropriate to, like, that 1930s setting as far as, like, the way science fiction was portrayed during that time. You know, so we're talking about rocket ships and robots and jetpacks and large-scale machinery, whereas
in laser guns.
Yeah, in the real world, technology got smaller, but in the 1930s, we always thought that machines would be giant, you know, like on an extreme level. Yeah. So, you know, and this movie in particular does have German scientists and specifically uses a Zeppelin at the beginning and throughout the film, the Hindenburg 3, to reflect that idea of that Germanic superiority in engineering. So that's kind of what you're getting into. So if you haven't seen this movie and you're listening to this just because you love the sound of my voice and Cesar's voice,
sneaky smooth.
And I'm a little hoarse today, actually, so please bear with me. But that's kind of what you're in for. Like Cesar says, very pulpy. Sort of like, I went back and rewatched the Max Fleischer Superman cartoon.
Versus the flying robots.
Yeah, it's, what is it called? I think it's just called The Mechanical Machines or something like that. Uh-huh. The Mechanical Monsters, which was done in 1941. And a lot of that influence is in Sky Captain. Obviously, there's no Superman in the story, but as far as the robots and the scientists and, you know, so, you know, like, this is not necessarily Buck Rogers because it's not in space, you know, like Flash Gordon, but, you know, it's like Rocket Men to the Moon and a bunch of those other B-grade serials that, you know, if you worked in the video industry like we did, you know, that are on, like, cheap alpha home video DVDs. So
not always, mostly though.
So it's an interesting approach. The visuals to this film, which I think are probably the thing that will be most striking for people. You know, it's got that high contrast lighting of like German expressionism, but it also has like a soft focus of like the 1920s, 1930s classic Hollywood era.
Yeah, you can tell with like the swipes and I guess scene transitions and such.
Yeah, apparently they achieved the look of the film by running footage through a diffusion filter and then tinting it into black and white before then blending in, balancing, and adding color. So it's an interesting visual approach, and on one hand I like it because of the retro look. On the other hand, and I don't know if you would agree with me, it's incredibly two-dimensional looking. There's like a lack of detail to the CG backgrounds and a lack of separation between like the actors and the background that kind of gives it a flat look.
It's not quite like, you know, like green screen backgrounds or painted backgrounds, but, it's very noticeable. Something that I did notice, for my screening for this recording, as opposed to, I guess it's probably been a few years since last time I saw the film. And I guess watching in HD on Netflix, brought some of that, more to my attention, certainly.
Yeah. Do you own this on DVD?
I have it on DVD, yeah, but okay. I watched it on Netflix for the screening.
I was almost certain that I owned this on DVD, and I tore through the place looking for it. But, I mean, everything's alphabetical, but I looked around just in case it wasn't alphabetical, and I could not find it. So I ended up watching this on Netflix, probably like everybody else. So I did watch a couple behind-the-scenes things on YouTube. And in one particular interview, Kevin Conroy, we should maybe jump back, and this was made by a guy named Kerry Conroy, or Conran?
Conran? Kerry
Conroy. Conran, yeah. And he was, he had a background in animation, didn't have the money or the clout to make a movie on his own, so he spent 4 years making a black and white trailer slash proof of concept test for this movie in his living room with a blue screen and an Apple computer, which is on YouTube. If you actually go to YouTube and punch in like Sky Captain original short, it's there. I recommend watching it. It's only 6 minutes long, and a lot of the shots in the final film are like recreated in an exacting way for the final film. Like, you know, the short's pretty impressive, actually.
but yeah, it's on the DVD, I believe.
It should be on the DVD. That's why I asked if you had it, but it is on YouTube if they want to watch it. And so, like, he made this 6-minute thing. They put together, a presentation. Producer John Avnet came on board. And then they were able to get Jude Law on board, and then Jude Law decided he would produce the movie as well as starring in it, and that's how they got Gwyneth Paltrow and Giovanni Ribisi and the rest of the cast on board. Showing that 6-minute short also got Angelina Jolie interested in the picture too. So, but this was the only major film in Kerry Conran's filmography. His brother, Kevin Conran, did costume design and production design for the film, and Kerry has not done much of anything since then, but Kevin has gone on to work in the art department of several large animated projects, such as like Monsters vs. Aliens and B-Movie, and I think he does that Dragons animated TV series from DreamWorks, too.
Okay.
And it became a family affair when his sister Kristen Conran came on board and did art direction for the picture. So, you know, this was a labor of love for him. And I guess after this movie came out, it was not a box office hit. It was number one the weekend it came out, which is funny because Netflix has that like on the synopsis. When you go to Netflix, it's like this... this terrific swashbuckling adventure was number one at the box office. But it only
number
made
the box office in March, I guess.
It was September. September of 2004. They list the production budget at $70 million, and it only made $58 million. So it was considered, like, I wouldn't consider it a flop, but it was not a successful movie. So if they had any ideas about doing sequels to Sky Captain, you know, that went out the door. But as I was doing research for this, or I wouldn't say I did a lot of research, but I kind of Googled a few things. There was an article from just a couple of years ago, I think in the Telegraph, and the article was how Kerry Conran saw the future of Hollywood and was left behind. And it had
about like all the full digital backdrop.
Yeah. Stuff. Yeah. This was touted as being like the first big, like, you know, this is the digital backlot. It's the future of Hollywood. And yeah, I mean, it did the success of this as far as being critically successful, because as I said, it wasn't financially successful, but it was critically successful. I don't have the Rotten Tomatoes score, but I know that it was pretty good. It was fresh.
Who cares what the Rotten Tomatoes score is?
Yeah, I agree, but I'm, you know, but it's a fresh rating on Rotten Tomatoes, and you know, so it was, the making of this movie was sort of revolutionary, and you know, Robert Rodriguez was kind of doing the same thing. The next year, he did Sin City. A couple years later, Zack Snyder did 300 in the, you know, using the same methods.
One thing I remember is that, like, this was one of three films that came out around the same time. They were in production simultaneously. There was it was Sky Captain that used like full digital backdrop. It was Sky Captain, a French film called Immortal Ad Vitam, and a Japanese film called Kashirin.
Yeah,
and I guess they're all released very close to each other. So I guess they, all three of them, kind of shared the distinction of being, I guess, like the first mostly digital films, I guess, shot.
Right.
I believe that's the distinction. I think Sin City was probably like a year or so later, but it was probably in production around the same time, though.
Yeah. And then, of course, you've got stuff like Speed Racer, which is the Wachowskis kind of doing their version of this. And then, of course, you know, Avatar. which also did not have, you know, any sets.
Yeah.
Any non-digital sets.
Yeah, and then, I guess, like, Star Wars had...
Well, I was going to mention that because, you know, everything I read as far as, like, production notes on Sky Captain or articles related to the picture, including the one that I mentioned from the Telegraph, they kind of tout it as, like, this is the next big thing, and no one's doing this. This is revolutionary. And I don't know if there's some conspiracy against George Lucas here, but, you know, with Radioland Murders and some of the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles, Lucas was already experimenting with this stuff a decade before this. And the Star Wars prequels had a lot of practical sets. You know, people don't realize how much model making and practical sets were in the Star Wars prequels. The digital backlot was something that he was doing for some major sequences in those. So not the entire film, but you know, a lot of the like the lightsaber battle with Darth Maul and Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan and Phantom Menace is all a virtual set. Most of Attack of the Clones is done with virtual sets, you know, and that was 2 years before Sky Captain came out. So I mean, you know, none of the Star Wars prequels are 100% digital backlot, because as we've come to realize at this point, audiences don't really like that look. That we've sort of rejected this. So like now, you know, if you look at the new Star Wars movies as an example, like, Star Wars fans rebelled against that whole digital look, and now they're building more practical sets for all these new films. And I think most major franchises are doing the same thing. you know, Marvel movies, all the costumes and all the sets are at least partially practical. They're building this stuff because they want to have a tactile quality to the visuals. So we've come to the point where like this digital backlot has sort of like come and gone in a way. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think Sky Captains is kind of like a weird artifact. It popped up at a time when CG started to blow people away again. I think the early 2000s were a period of time when CG kind of like advanced drastically forward, farther than it had in a really long time, the years previous. And Sky Captain kind of seemed to be the like the culmination of like high quality CG, albeit stylistic, if not realistic. So you can kind of say that it's an artifact of its time, despite being an homage to an earlier time, which I think is kind of interesting to note about this movie.
Absolutely. Well, like the design of the film itself, it's sort of retro and advanced at the same time.
Yes.
I think you make a good point there about it being stylistic versus realistic. One of the things that I took away from one of the behind the scenes things, let me find it real quick. Yeah, according to Kevin Conroy, Kerry Conroy doesn't really do interviews or anything related to this film. He's
okay. I'm just gonna say again, it's Conran, not Conroy. You're confusing Batman, I guess.
You're right. I actually wrote the right name though. I just can't say it. Sorry. All right. According to Kevin Conran, in an interview, they were never attempting photorealism with the film. They were striving for more comic book visuals. So I think in that way, the film is successful. You know, it has the feeling of an animated film. The way it's cut, the way it's paced, especially you know the first act of the film. You could actually replace the actors with cartoon animated characters, and it would feel like almost like a DC Comics animated movie.
Yeah, I think so.
So,
especially with I guess a lot of animation these days, having moved to digital animation, not necessarily 3D, even if 2D stuff is done digitally, so it doesn't have the animated on paper look to it anymore.
Yeah. I quite like the look of the film. I mean, I do think it's if this movie was done now, it would look better, and I think you would have better color grading. The backgrounds would be better. You'd have more depth in the shots. But like you said, it's, you know, it's an artifact of its time. And you know, story wise and character wise, I have some issues with this film. But the designs, the look, I mean, that stuff's all A+, you know?
Yeah. I think, Sky Captain was the year it came out was one of my favorite movies of the year. You know, I guess stylistically, I don't think anyone who sees the film is going to doubt that, how cool it looks. And I think it's more of a high concept, type of film, but it's a high concept that really kind of hits my sweet spot, so to speak. I really like that kind of pulpy, you said swashbuckling. I'm not sure if that was Netflix's words or your own, but that kind of period science fiction action, it's something I truly love. You know, things like you mentioned earlier, like The Rocketeer, it just kind of speaks to me, I guess.
Yeah, I know you're a big fan of The Rocketeer. I think The Rocketeer is a better movie.
I think so too. Rocketeer, yeah. Though, I have no small amount of love for.
Yeah, that's true. You've mentioned that before. So, well, let's dig into like the story, and so I mean, I think it's a little cheesy, and I think the acting is flat. But there are sequences in this film that I think work extremely well, and I think especially the first act is very strong, up to. The aftermath of the assault on New York.
Okay.
So, you know, when they lay out the fact that, you know, these scientists are going missing, you know, and who Polly Perkins is and what's going on with that, I like the Radio City Music Hall sequence and the Wizard of Oz use, you know, and then, you know, as soon as the scientist flees the theater, right, the robots come in. And then you get this massive sequence with these robots, and Sky Captain is called in. And there's some great visuals there. And I also want to note that the music in the movie is really well done.
Yes.
There's sort of like a rousing kind of like cliffhanger serial score to it.
I'm not sure who did the score for it.
The music was done by Ed Shearmer. S-H-E-A-R-M-U-R. Sure.
Yeah, that's not a name I'm familiar with.
He had a run of popular films in the early 2000s, including like Miss Congeniality, Reign of Fire, and Charlie's Angels. But okay. You know, nothing else like super major. But it's good work in this movie, though.
Yeah, I mean, I do like the score quite a bit. Very, very rousing, I guess is the right word for it.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at his filmography. Yeah, it's a lot of consistent work, I guess, but nothing with an iconic score, I imagine.
Yeah.
Not really, no. Okay. All right. Let's move on. Sorry, Ed.
That's okay. Well, I don't know how you feel about the leads of the film. I don't think Gwyneth Paltrow and Jude Law have much chemistry in this movie at all.
I would agree with you. Generally, except that I think their acting is presented in a way that's in line with what they're paying homage to. So I don't know if that's necessarily a conscious choice, but I think it fits for the film. I do think Gwyneth Paltrow, I mean, I guess I do like her character of Polly, but she, you know, a lot of the acting does seem, her in particular, does seem pretty bland.
Yeah, I think she's horribly miscast in this. I mean, I like Gwyneth Paltrow. I've liked her in a lot of movies, and she's certainly beautiful. But at some point, she's like doing like almost like this Southern Belle accent. You know, like when she's talking to her editor, who's actually played by Michael Gambon in the movie for like two scenes.
I totally forgot he was in there.
And she's like, you know what a careful girl I am, Mr. Haley. but like she does that for like three or four points in the movie where there's sort of like a Southern accent to it, like a draw that she has. And then like the rest of the movie, she completely loses it. And she never really achieves that, like, you know, they're going for like that sort of like prickly, like 1930s, that spunky, you know, like Lois Lane, Dale Arden, Princess Leia type thing. You know, they're obviously going for that. And I don't think, you know, she's more of a slinky,
maybe better towards like a femme fatale style.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, she's tall and thin. She's more of a Gilda character than she is sort of like you need a Carol Lombard type in this role, and Gwyneth Paltrow does not fit the bill at all. She's not horrible in the movie, you know. I don't want to go that far, but like I feel like she's miscast, and I think that it's a little bit detrimental to that character in particular.
Okay, I think that's fair. Among the performances in the film, I do feel she's definitely the weakest link. I don't think that she is as bad maybe not bad, but I don't think it's as weak a performance as you seem to think. But then again, I do like this film overall, so I kind of can forgive a lot of stuff considering what the movie brings to the table.
Yeah, well, I think Jude Law's fine, although like, you know, with a character by the name of Joe Sullivan, I'm sort of looking for more of like a, you know, rough and tumble like Irish boxer, but
as opposed to
sort of like, I guess they're going for like a more dashing or debonair quality with him, but I don't really get that from his performance. But he's still fine, But I think the biggest drawback is that they don't have a lot of chemistry. And some of that is the writing. Some of that's really not on them. But in the scenes where they're supposed to have some sort of like tension and conflict, you know, or you know, romantic tension and conflict, like I don't necessarily buy it the way that I would in some of the great, you know, previous pairings and other great movies where you have that type of thing, like a Katharine Hepburn and Cary Grant, or a William Powell and Myrna Loy. Yeah, that part of it, that relationship between Polly and Joe, is not quite as strong as I would like it to be in this film. So I think that if they could have shored that up, I think I'd like this movie a lot better than I do.
Okay.
And I'm fine with Angelina Jolie, who I'm actually not that big a fan of typically, but she's got a convincing British accent. Okay. She's an ace flight commander for the RAF, which is awesome. And she's got a fucking eye patch.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm all on board with Frankie.
Yeah, the I guess like the flight deck, the command room flight deck, definitely made me think of like the SHIELD helicarrier.
Absolutely. Like, I wrote that down. That's funny. Yeah, it's exactly like the same kind of thing.
But you know, I wonder if, you know, it's this the same influence anyway, but I think it was realized in Avengers, it was realized very similar to the way it was portrayed in Sky Captain.
Yeah. And you mentioned earlier when you gave your description of the film that this is sort of like a alternate telling of history.
Well, I mean, there's a Hindenburg 3.
Right. But, like, I had trouble trying to figure out, like, if Sky Captain and his Flying Legion are an independent organization, like G.I. Joe or S.H.I.E.L.D., or if they're part of, like, the government, because they never really get into that, and it really doesn't matter, but, like, I don't know, I just wanted to know, but they don't really, you know, get into that at all.
Oh, yeah, I mean, I guess not, but, I mean, I guess, like, Joe's got, like, people at his, because, I mean, he's got his own kind of, like, airfield.
Right.
On, like, another island, right? And there are people in uniform there, but I guess I don't know enough about military, like, you know, stripes or medals to know if, like, yeah, they're wearing anything that's kind of accurate. Or, well, you know, I mean, it is alternate, so there's no real explanation necessary for it, I think.
Yeah. And, well, when they have the robots attacking New York and they send their plea out to Sky Captain for help, they mention that they're using, like, an emergency protocol. So, you know, maybe they're only authorized to contract the Flying Legion to help out in certain situations.
Yeah, maybe.
Probably reading too much into this.
Maybe they're more like a Doc Savage type of role, you know.
Oh, just, man. I can't wait for them to do a good Doc Savage movie.
I think the one from the 70s isn't that bad, man. It's bad, but, like, it's pretty entertaining stuff.
That's a ringing endorsement right there. Well, you know, Shane Black was going to do a Doc Savage movie for a long time, and I don't know if that's still on the table, but
yeah, I don't know if he's still attached.
He would be I'm not sure he's the perfect person to do it, but it seems like he loves the, you know, that era and that series of books. So, like, I would certainly give him a chance.
Yeah, I mean, I think a director of his caliber who makes films that I enjoy quite a lot, if you give him the opportunity to work on something that he loves himself, I think the results could be really terrific, though.
Yeah. I think the biggest thing they had when he was originally, like, after he wrote a script and they started to develop it further, I think the biggest thing was they just could not find someone who could play Doc Savage.
I know The Rock was, his name was thrown around in it for
quite a while. And I don't know if he's still attached or not. You know, he's maybe a fine choice.
He does like 3 or 4 movies a year, so, I mean, who knows?
Or 18. Speaking of which, 2004, when this came out, was the year of Jude Law.
Oh, it definitely was, yeah. One of the things I think that, you know, you mentioned earlier the film was not a box office success, but one of the things I really attribute, like, it's not just 2004, maybe like the year previous as well.
His overexposure?
Overexposure, yeah. I think he and Colin Farrell kind of experienced it both at the same time.
Definitely. They were just everywhere. Jude Law had 6 movies come out in 2004.
Which ones were they?
I didn't write them down. But
it was like
Alfie, and Lemony Snicket, and this one, and there were a few others. Was closer in that?
Was closer like 2005, 2006 maybe?
Yeah, it might have been. But I think the biggest thing is when...
I heard Huckabees, that was 2004, right?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, that's a good one. That's a good pull right there. God, I hate that movie.
All right.
It's got so many people in it that I love.
Let's watch it next.
And, and I rewatched it like 2 years ago, and I still just could not get through it. Like, I just don't like that movie at all.
So it's safe to say that CJ does not heart Huckabees.
No, I don't. But I do love the people who are in it. You know, fucking Lily Tomlin and Jason Schwartzman, and I love all those guys.
Okay, great.
Dustin Hoffman.
Mark Wahlberg.
Bring it on. Let's do it. But yeah, the thing that I was going to say is, you know, when these young actors who are just on the cusp of stardom have so much material coming out, a lot of times people end up rejecting, you know, them because they don't like being... having a movie star like thrust upon them, I think.
Yeah.
And we saw it in the, I guess the mid to late 2000s with Sam Worthington too, where he popped up in like a lot of big projects in like a 2 year period when he was like Clash of the Titans and Avatar and Terminator and stuff, like right in a row. And people were like,
"Best big import from outside of the United States."
Yeah. We were like, "Who the fuck is Sam Worthington?" But I think Ben Affleck had that happen. Jude Law had that happen. You mentioned Colin Farrell had that happen. And I think it's just, you know, I think that overexposure could have been, you know, one of the factors in some of his movies not performing as well that year. So I think you're right.
Well, we also mentioned, mentioned Colin Farrell. I think it's a little bit interesting because he's also an actor who would continually make films, but a lot of times they sat on the shelf. Until he made it big, and then studios would release films already done. The two big examples being, I want to say, Tigerland and Phone Booth. Phone Booth specifically, I believe, was on the shelf for 2 or 3 years before they actually released it theatrically.
Yeah, and that had a big, like, long production history too. Like Jim Carrey was supposed to play that role originally. Do you remember that?
I don't know.
Yeah, that Phone Booth starring Jim Carrey.
Yeah,
okay. We kind of got that with Anchorman, though, in the same year. Anchorman came out in 2004, and you get Will Ferrell screaming in a phone booth, so.
Yeah. Well, there you go. You had seen. That's where that movie came from.
Yep. But yeah, like, Colin Farrell and Jude Law are both guys who are making, like, great choices now, and, like, you know, now they've aged a bit and are taking different kinds of roles. Like, they're really nailing it.
Yeah, I mean, I think when you look at, I mean, as an actor, you can't really, like, you know, continually turn down roles, you know. So I guess if you're not actually working, you're technically unemployed, and you know, it's better to keep your face in the spotlight as opposed to like drifting off into obscurity.
Yeah, keep yourself sharp.
Yeah.
So pivoting back, I guess, to Sky Captain, where'd we leave off? I think we were talking about the Flying Legion and the RAF helicarriers. And
Yeah.
So that sequence is pretty cool when they meet Frank. She comes in late in the movie, though.
Yeah, I want to see the movie's like more than halfway over by the time you see Angelina Jolie for the first time.
Yeah, because you've got that horrible like Shangri-La sequence before that.
Hmm. Yeah, where they wake up after like the explosion in the snow.
Yeah, well, that's a terrible moment. But even on a larger scale, like the Shangri-La bit could have been an entire like adventure on its own. It could have been awesome. But Conrad sort of glosses over the whole thing, and it feels less visually interesting than the rest of the film, and nothing really happens there. They're freaking Shangri-La, and there's not even like a bunch of like amazing shots of the place.
Like, so, they just got to save the world, CJ.
Right. Yeah. So, well, but
they only had time for this peaceful shit.
instead of being like something that maybe they could have set aside and said, if this movie is a success, we'll do like a big Shangri-La adventure with Sky Captain.
Captain returns to Shangri-La.
Yeah, they'll never get that chance now. But it just drags the film down. And it's really a shame because the idea of them finding Shangri-La could have been awesome.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely one of the threads that tends to be pretty common. I mean, there are a couple like bullet points you can kind of check off for a science fiction serial, whether it's like, you know, dinosaurs. I mean, this movie does it all.
It really does.
Dinosaurs, you know, robots, you know, unrealistic science, bombs, rockets, you know, what have you. It kind of like covers everything. So maybe the fact that it wasn't like expounded upon is probably, you know, just an effort for them to kind of cram what they can into it in an effort. I mean, I kind of look at this movie and it seemed to me like it was going to be pretty risky for a studio to release the film. And maybe Conran kind of felt the same way. So he figured, you know, this may be the only time I'm able to play around with stuff like this. So why not just put what I can in there, you know? I mean, he even has Godzilla and King Kong in the movie, so.
Yeah, once they get to the Totenkopf's Island with all that the creatures and stuff like that, it feels like Kipling's The Lost World.
Yeah.
And then you've got this, like, and they really gloss over this, which could have been a cool, like, side adventure too, but that, like, they talk about the experiments that Totenkopf runs, and then in, is it in Shangri-La? Where they visit the guy who has the, like, the cancers, tumors and stuff all over him? Where he gives them the staff and tells them how to get to Totenkopf's Island, and then he's like, kill me.
Yes.
So you get, like, a weird, like, Dr. Moreau quality to it as well. Like, but that's never, like, expanded upon. It's just kind of, like, a blip.
A little bit of body horror going on.
Yeah, it's just, like, a little blip on Sky Captain's radar. So, because, you know, I mean, for better or worse, and I think for the better, this is more concerned with popcorn entertainment than, you know, posing deeper questions about science and the morality of stuff like that. So, I also like the little, when they go to, they go into, the, like, the lab, and they find, like, the miniaturized elephant.
Yeah.
So, I like that bit. It reminds me of, like, Looney Tunes.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, that scene, you also get an extended look at Bai Ling's kind of robotic, Totenkopf's bionic agent.
Right. His gynoid.
Gynoid.
Yeah.
Is she ever referred to as that? What is that?
it's just a female android.
Is that what they? Is that like an actual term?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I didn't just make it up.
Are you sure?
Hey, look it up.
Okay. Later.
Maybe. But yeah, Bai Ling doesn't have a single word in the movie, which is a shame. She's silent. I mean, that's sort of, she's labeled as mysterious woman in the credits. So, and the character does have a mysterious quality to her. Cool outfit. She's kind of like the Darth Maul of the piece.
Yeah, I mean, she even fights with the staff too, yeah.
Yeah, well, and they have that shot in Totenkopf's lair when Jude Law, Sky Captain, is going across like a bridge, and they have like a blast door open, and she walks out with her staff and a bunch of robots, and it's like right out of a Star Wars prequel.
There you go.
Yep. There's a lot of Star Wars references in this movie, which I'm sure
Star Wars is also like, you know, influenced by that kind of stuff too, though.
Yeah. Yeah, but it should be no surprise. I mean, like, the doctor's lab that they go into is, like, door number 1138, you know, which it references THX-1138. And when Sky Captain lands on Frankie's aircraft carrier, it's platform 327, which is the same platform number that the Millennium Falcon lands on in Cloud City.
Okay. Well, I mean, if...
sorry, nerding out there.
I kind of seem to remember that Kerry Conran went went to CalArts.
Yes.
So, I mean, maybe he feels he can, like, attach it.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. Simple stuff. Okay. Yeah, I'm not going to look it up.
That's okay. So, how do we feel about this use of Laurence Olivier in the film?
Oh, I dislike it. You know, I think there's an ethical question that exists in this.
Now, we did not do a podcast on Rogue One, A Star Wars Story, but I had many conversations with people about the use of Peter Cushing as Grand Moff Tarkin in that film, and I think, you know, this, you know, has a similar, you know, thing going on here, obviously, with them using archival footage of Laurence Olivier. I agree with you 100%. I'm not for it. I don't know, you know, I don't know if you want to, you know, get deeper into your stance on it, but my feeling is actors make specific choices, and a lot of actors make specific choices based on looking at their filmography and what they want to leave behind, their legacy. And when we do this with actors like Peter Cushing or Laurence Olivier, you're not giving them a chance to make that choice on their own.
Yeah, that's my exact stance too.
Okay. I
mean, you know, they should be afforded the opportunity to say no.
Right.
With them being dead, there's no opportunity.
Right. Cause in both cases, and hey, you know, I mean, you know, their families own their likenesses, and, you know, the studios or film production companies owned the footage that they used, you know, to recreate these characters in these movies. You know, so ultimately it becomes commerce, you know, that they're basically, you know, profiting off of some dead person, you know, like putting Elvis on a paper plate or something like that.
Yeah.
And it's no better or worse, you know, it's not an artistic choice. It is a commercial choice. I don't know. I guess that's the end of my argument there. I'm just, you know, I don't like it.
Yeah, I mean, I can imagine people being just okay with it. Yeah, I think our stance is probably the popular one, far and away the popular one, I imagine, you know.
Well, it's funny because they use Laurence Olivier and they actually reference Wuthering Heights in the film. They have, I guess, three movie billboards up in the city. Wizard of Oz, obviously, Wuthering Heights, and King's Row. So they reference Wuthering Heights, and then they turn around and use Laurence Olivier as the bad guy. Sorry, Heathcliff.
Well, what other references, cool references, do you recall in the movie? Well, I mentioned, you know, the Godzilla and King Kong.
Yeah, I don't remember seeing King Kong. Where the hell is King Kong?
During the robot sequence,
yeah.
You don't. It's not obvious, but like, there's during the.
Oh, wait, is he on the Empire State Building?
Yes. So, yeah. Like, during a shot while the Sky Captain's flying, you see a figure on top of the Empire State Building.
Okay. I do think I remember reading that, but I didn't catch it while I was watching the movie, actually.
Well, I think, like, for me, I still... It'd been, like I said, more than a handful of years since I saw this film last, but I'd seen it... I think probably this most recent viewing, you know, probably played to me around 10 viewings of the movie, so I remembered where to kind of direct my eyes, I think, at that moment during my rewatch.
Wow, you've seen this movie 10 times?
Probably.
Wow. All right. You do like this movie.
I was really taken with the film back then, so.
Hey, nothing wrong with that.
Plus, we played it a lot at Suncoast, so.
We did have a little playlist a few times. I remember that.
My choice.
It's eye-catching. Do we actually like Joe Sullivan?
I think he's fine. Yeah, why not? He's cool, debonair. He has a cool airplane. I like Giovanni Ribisi's Dex character quite a lot, though.
Well, you know, it's funny you mention that, because, like, I hate the way Sky Captain goes around saying good boy Dex all the time.
Well, I think, you know, Dex is actually a dog.
Are you trying to say that Giovanni Ribisi is as ugly as a dog?
No, I think it's just maybe a term like, you know, old sport or old chum or what have you. You know, it's positive reinforcement for like this kid that looks up the Sky Captain, I guess.
All right. Well, it, I don't think it plays like that, but I'm okay with that being your take on it. I think he comes off as being kind of a dick.
Well, I mean, you don't get to become the greatest pilot in the world by, you know, playing nice and not waving your dick around, I guess.
All right. I like the final shot of this movie, and I like where this movie ends. I actually like, it's a cute little button for them to end on. Because you've got that, you've got the gag with her losing her film with the in the explosion in the mountains of Nepal.
Yes.
The
dynamite shaft.
Yeah, yeah. And then so like she's only got two photographs left for half the movie, and she sees all these amazing things, like crazy amazing things, and she can't like bring herself to actually take the photographs. Because she's worried that she'll miss the greatest of those things later. And at the end of the movie, she has her chance to take one final shot of all the animals parachuting into the water and Frankie's ships flying over. And it would have been a great, you know, shot for the front of a newspaper. And instead, you know, because her heart is with Joe, she turns and takes a photograph of Joe. And, you know, Joe has that, like, what are you doing look on his face. And she thinks it's because he is taken aback that she would rather use her final shot on him. But it's because she leaves the lens cap on the camera. And so, like, our final shot is...
Is the lens cap actually on?
It's not. It's actually off, it looks like, on the shot. But I think it's funny, though, because our last shot is of her basically realizing that she... that she wasted her final shot. And then it goes right into the credits. And I really think that it was a great instinct to leave the movie on that note.
Yeah. I think the movie's got quite a bit of fun little... I wouldn't say, little cute. You said cute button, but I think that's very true. I think some of their little byplays, I like a lot. I know you said they didn't have that much chemistry in your opinion, but like I think that's a moment that kind of personifies like, you know, one of the things I really enjoy about this film.
Yeah, well, I don't think there's a lot of sweetness or cuteness or romance in their relationship. And I feel like that stuff could have been amped up and really helped the picture.
You think it was romantic when he cold clocked her?
No, but that's actually from that era. Like that happens in a ton of movies where, you know, like the go-getter female character is so excited to join the fight that the male character has to, like, you know, knock her out. It's actually like I've been rewatching the Thin Man movies recently.
Yeah, I noticed that. Yeah,
and in the first Thin Man movie, Nick and Nora are in bed and a gunman comes into the bedroom, and Nick throws a pillow at the gunman and he clocks Nora so that she's out of the way, and then he goes to get the gunman. So like that's happened in quite a few movies, and I think that that's actually like appropriate to like the period setting that they're in. But I like the fact that she gets back at him by saving him. So he gets beat up by the mysterious woman character, and then she saves him and then clocks him. So like he gets, you know, punched in the face by two different women all in like a 30-second period.
Yeah, that's a good moment. I think
I like Jude Law getting punched in the face by women. That's fine.
Where other instances does this happen?
I don't know. I can't think of any offhand, but it happens in a lot of movies where the
he gets slapped more than a couple times in Alfie.
Oh yeah, definitely. I don't know. We should put together an entire like montage of Jude Law getting like drinks poured on him and smacked and punched.
Getting insulted.
Yeah.
his honor being tarnished.
Well, you know, Michael Gambon, who was the second Dumbledore, is in this movie. And Jude Law is now playing the young Dumbledore in the new Fantastic Beasts movie.
Oh, yeah.
So if they replaced Laurence Olivier with Richard Harris, they would have had all three Dumbledores in this movie.
Well, I think that's interesting, except, you know, Jude Law and Michael Gambon in this film never had a scene together.
They don't, but, you know, they're in it, so it's cool.
It counts.
They were probably on set one day together. Who knows?
There was no set. It was just...
They were standing at the coffee cart next to the blue screen, all right?
Yeah. Talking with their English accents.
Just let me have this one, Cesar.
Okay, you win. You can have it.
Thank you. All right, final thoughts?
You know, Sky Captain, I really like it. It taps into a... maybe kind of like a childhood interest in kind of like that super science, that idea of the past. I think when you look at past interpretations of the future and technology and science, you know, dreams were a lot bigger than they ever turned out into. You know, flying cars and giant robots and rocket ships and traveling long distances, space travel, you know. When you look at like the state of the world and kind of like the imagination, it doesn't seem like the world has as big, or, you know, the dreams aren't as big. They're content to have smaller steps. I'd say a movie that I like that has a similar theme would be, I guess, Brad Bird's Tomorrowland. I like the idea of, you know, possibility. And I think this movie brings a lot to it.
Well stated, sir. I agree with you. I mean, like, I think it's really sad that, you know, that type of optimism and imagination is sort of, I don't know, soured a bit.
Yeah. The cynical state of things.
Yeah. I mean, what happened to the idea of wanting to colonize Mars and you know, make the first flying car and all that good stuff. So, I mean, like. It's a period in our history as far as like fiction and literature and movies and stuff that I quite like. You know, like you called it like super science. Like I always call it like retrofuturism, but that it's certainly worth watching for that. You know, I like I mentioned, I have some problems with the, you know, with the acting and. You know, things just not being energetic enough, I think, between the actors is the biggest thing, which is a problem that I think, you know, people had to learn how to act in front of green screens. You know, I think there was a period of adjustment for filmmakers, you know, as far as like trying to bring out good performances when actors didn't have that external stimulus. And, you know, we certainly saw it with the Star Wars prequels, and you see it, I think, a little bit with some of the other CG-heavy movies of this time period. We've certainly gotten better, and, you know, I think when you look at the blockbusters now, we're going to look back and feel really fortunate to have lived through, you know, like... the movies that we're living in right now, you know, with these Marvel movies and the new Star Wars pictures and stuff like that. And I mean, how long has it been since this movie? 14 years?
A little under 14 years.
Yeah. But you know, at the same time period that this came out, we were in the middle of the Star Wars prequels, the Harry Potter movies, Lord of the Rings.
Yeah. Lord of the Rings had just wrapped up.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, like the age of the blockbuster, the special effects driven blockbuster, you know, really started in the 90s, I guess, the late 90s, and hasn't stopped. And they've gotten better at it. You know, I'm I'm surprised the last couple of years that, you know, even though I don't love a lot of these blockbusters that are coming out, like, none of them are, like, super horrible. Like, we've gotten to the point where, like, quality control has gotten way better on them.
Yeah, well, I think that brings another problem, though, because I think none of them are super horrible, but nothing is special, you know? I think Sky Captain kind of stands alone because I think it's a special movie. It's got imagination. You know, it's I guess, you know, it is homage, but it is an original movie.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's definitely one of the things that's missing from big, you know, big blockbusters this time.
All right, you've convinced me. It's pretty good.
Yeah.
Cool.
I took that one back.
Yep. Point Cesar.
There you go. I'll take it.
Cool.
How about you? Final thoughts?
Nah, that was it. I'm done. Yeah. I'm done. I hope people watch it and you know, decide for themselves and
check it out, guys. You know.
Yeah. Tell us what you think of it.
I mean, I think, you know, I've said multiple times during the recording how much I like this film, and, you know, it's on Netflix. You could do way worse than giving 100 minutes of your time to this film.
Yeah. Looking at you, Bright.
I haven't watched it yet, so. I just got some movies, so. Movies on discs, so I'll probably try to hit those. Old stuff, though.
Nothing wrong with that. So I'm going to finish out my Thin Man series, then I'm going to dive back into... Yeah, as you know, I started watching Hitchcock's filmography last year in conjunction with that TCM Ball State University course that I was doing.
Yeah.
So I only got about halfway through his filmography before the class ended. So I want to go back and I'm going to finish watching all the Hitchcock movies this year.
Okay.
So I've got about 30 of them.
Well, you can do it, man.
Got about 30 more to go. I'm
February.
Maybe a little less. I think I'm at 23 or 24 and I think he made 53 movies. One of which was sort of lost, and they still haven't been able to find a usable copy of it. So I'm probably right around halfway done.
Yeah. I think there was a Japanese actor, Osugi Ren, who just passed away. So I'm probably going to watch a bunch of movies with him in it. He was in movies like with Beat Takeshi. So he's in movies like Hanabi, Son of Teen.
Outrage?
He is Outraged, the first one.
Okay.
But he was also in, like, Audition, a number of Takashi Miike films.
Okay.
Dead or Alive. So I just, you know, I guess last year I got the Dead or Alive Blu-ray set, but I never sat down and watched them. So probably, maybe I'll hammer out those three films. See? Those movies are fucking crazy. But, yeah, it's been almost 20 years since I've seen them. So there you go.
Awesome. You going to do reviews for the website?
Yeah, I want to. I have a couple reviews that I have scheduled to go up. So in case I miss any, I've been writing tons of reviews, but I just don't want to, you know, inundate the page with stuff. The current review I have is for a Japanese food documentary called Eat Trip. It's a documentary, so mostly no-name people, but it does have Tadanobu Asano in it, who plays himself drinking tea. It's pretty compelling.
Nice.
Tadanobu Asano, people would know him probably in the United States for his role as Hogan in the Thor films.
Okay.
We should not be here. That's what he says.
Gotcha. Well, for our listeners, make sure that you're checking Film Smash and reading up Cesar's reviews. Give him the clicks.
Yes, I'll take it, guys.
Yeah. Cool. Where can people find you on the internet, Mr. Cesar?
Well, filmsmash.com. You can also find me on Twitter at JuniorBijo. How about you, CJ? Where are you at?
They can always find me on Twitter at Setting the Frame and on our Facebook page for Celluloid Jelly. Make sure you guys interact, join the discussion, and we look forward to hearing from you.
Yeah, okay, cool.
Cool. All right, thanks, Cesar.
Yeah, thanks, CJ. Everyone, watch Sky Captain.
And the World of Tomorrow.
Okay, yeah, do it.
Celluloid Jelly was recorded using Google Hangouts, mixed using Apple's GarageBand software, and hosted by Podbean. For any inquiries related to Celluloid Jelly, please email settingtheframe@gmail.com.